Those of you who have studied in yeshivas most probably came into contact with one of the great ethical classics of all, the Mesilat Yesharim, the Path of the Just. I have a sneaky suspicion that when they tried to teach us Mesilat Yesharim when we were 15, 16 years old, we didn't really like it too much. Now those of us who were fortunate, as we grew up and matured, we'd come back to the Mesilat Yesharim and we would see the brilliance of that sefer. I recommend it very highly. It's even an English translation, The Path of the Just. I just want to study a very small section, a paragraph, and I want to elaborate on that paragraph because I think it has a great deal to say to us today. I think Jerry alluded to the fact that we are going through extremely difficult times, and in difficult times we have to be able to see things clearly. We as Jews can never afford to have a blurred vision. The Mesilat Yesharim says the following: Darkness can bring man to two kinds of errors, two kinds of mistakes. We'll read a few lines. Ki nechoshach halayla, the darkness of night, shnei minei tauyot, efshalo shiyigron le'ein ha'adam. The darkness of night can cause man's eyes to err in two different ways. It's possible either it closes the eye is covered and simply can't see what's there in front of a person. He can't see, it's closed. Blocks his vision. There's even the possibility that may have a little vision, but it'll be a confused vision. He may see a pillar and think it's a human being, or a human being and think that it's a pillar. Of course, what will be necessary is in the event that there'll be a great burst of light, all of a sudden he'll be able to see all of the pitfalls, what to avoid, where he can go, when he can't go. But there is another form of darkness, the Mesilat Yesharim says. And that form of darkness is a great deal more dangerous, far, far more serious, and far, far more difficult to correct. That second form of darkness is an intellectual darkness. A human being can see clearly, 20/20 vision. He can see everything in front of him. The only thing is he has a skewed view of the world. And he's capable of seeing that which is good and saying it's bad. And that which is bad, he sees as though it's good. He doesn't have his priorities straight. He doesn't have the ability to judge. He's got it all wrong. Now that's far, far more difficult to correct. So if we hear what's going to be necessary, it's not simply the great burst of light and all of a sudden you can see clearly what stands before you. It's going to require a process of education, of remaking, reforming, and reshaping the individual so that he can think straight. And it's only when he thinks straight that he will be able to see far more clearly what lies ahead of him. And he says, "V'hataot hasheni," the second mistake, "v'hu kasheh min harishon," far more difficult than the first. "Shemater riyatam," it confuses one's vision until they see ra ki iluhu mamish tov. Ra, what's truly bad, they see this as great, a great opportunity. This is tremendous. And that which is absolute good, they see it as evil. And this is something that can cause terrible, terrible suffering, terrible destruction to the human being and those who surround him. As I studied this piece of the Mesilat Yesharim, Obviously, I began to think of the situation in which we find ourselves, and this evening is going to be devoted to the last 11 years in the life of Medinat Yisrael, and more than anything else, to prepare us for what may come during the course of the next number of months or the next year. There's a great deal of unease, to say the very least, with regard to what the future may hold. So let's begin from the beginning. The two mistakes that the Mesilat Yeshavim is talking about are mistakes that have stamped themselves upon the Jewish people during the course of the last 11 years. There were those who simply couldn't see ahead. There was a form of darkness that descended, a darkness that descended 11 years ago. And what should have been seen by any intelligent human being as holding within it the seeds of tragedy was looked upon many as this is the great opportunity. A new dawn. Let the sun rise. 100 years of war is over. Our grandchildren will no longer need to fight again. Down with our weapons. There were those who believed that a world-class gangster, arch-terrorist, is going to come in. And when you say it now, it sounds so foolish, so ridiculous. But they believed it. There were people who believed it. He's going to protect us from terrorism. As Rabin had said, he's going to protect us without the restraints of a Supreme Court, without concern about human rights organizations. They really believed that he was going to kill fellow Arabs in order to save Jews. It staggers the imagination. It staggers the imagination. That's what they believed. People were convinced to thinking that this is really the dawn of a new era. They call us right-wingers. They accuse us of being messianic. Oh, we're not messianic. Anybody who thought that Oslo was going to work, he was messianic. He was living in a dream world, in an inability to see what should have been seen clearly, should have been seen clearly. There were others who, because of their particular approach to life, to Judaism, to Eretz Israel, had things completely topsy-turvy. And they still do. The great obstacle to peace, Jews living in Eretz Israel, Yehuda, and Shomron, and Azov, this is the obstacle to peace. It's unbelievable. Staggers the imagination. They're the obstacle to peace. There's something sick about the idea that we can sort of accuse ourselves and we are the ones that carry the blame for this terrible situation that exists in the Middle East. But there were those who saw this great undertaking of Yishuv HaAretz as something to be destroyed, and they will stop at nothing until they do it. Or until they hope that they will be able to do it. And of course now we are, yes, I don't know, you see, you have to know, I always say that the rule in modern Jewish history is expect the unexpected. You never know what's going to happen. I came here on Monday night, somebody asked me, well, how's the situation in Eretz Yisrael? So I said, I'm out of Eretz Yisrael a few hours. I don't have a clue. It changes hour by hour. Before I left, by the way, my wife didn't make it with me. because I had to leave her. I told her, watch Eretz Yisrael till I come back. And I spoke to her tonight. She's watching. Very difficult to imagine what's going to happen in Zer. I want to tell you, there are certain things that we have to be very careful of. 2 years ago, Mizrahi invited me to Johannesburg for Yom Yerushalayim. They had a beautiful Yom Yerushalayim gathering in Johannesburg. They invited me in as speaker. I'll tell you, I got up to speak. I had a terrible sore throat. I was on the verge to laryngitis, and I was playing with the Rebbeinu Shalom, just get me through this speech. So I started off by telling them, that day in the paper they had a report of a speech that had been made by President Bush the day before, at which he talked about a window of opportunity that had opened up. I said, every time a window of opportunity opens up, I get a sore throat. I get sick from every window of opportunity. They're talking about it now. There's a new window of opportunity. I feel already, I'm getting the shivers already. I need orange juice. What kind of windows of opportunity are opening up? But what we have to do is, after learning this Mesillas Yesharim, that there are forms of blindness, darkness. The first that he speaks of is a darkness that in a sense is technical in nature. I simply can't see what's ahead of me. The second is an intellectual darkness, the one that is far, far more difficult to correct because it's part of one's entire lifestyle, what one believes, what one thinks, what one feels. But as I studied in the Mesillas Yesharim, it occurred to me that there are another number of kinds of darkness that pervade the Jewish people, and we have to be aware of them, and we have to be able to identify them in order that we make sure not to fall into the same trap again. There's something that we have to walk away with after 11 years. We have to be able to say, we learned something in these 11 years. We're not going to make the same mistakes as the past. One of these forms of blindness, which is not mentioned by the Mesillas Yesharim, because the Mesillas Yesharim could never have imagined that kind of blindness. I call it turning a blind eye. Soon after the Oslo Accords, the violations began together with the Accords. Violation after violation. Supposed to be 12,000 police, 40,000 police. So many weapons, more weapons, and we're giving them weapons. Why don't you stop it? Why don't you do something? Why don't you say something? Why don't you just let them know that until these violations are corrected, we're not going ahead with anything? What did our leadership do? Our leadership turned a blind eye. They became the apologists. There are problems. They need more police. They need more weapons. They can't do it. What do you mean turning a blind eye? Anybody who really wanted Oslo to succeed, if you really wanted it to succeed, at the very first violation, they should have told him, we're not going one step further until you keep your word. It's 11 years later. Does anybody remember what the first commitment was that was made by the Palestinians? The first commitment that was made was that they were going to change their covenant that calls for the destruction of the state of Israel. How many times did we hear, yes, they're meeting, yes, it's in committee, yes, it's going to happen. They even brought Clinton to Gaza for some kind of a ceremony. Believe me, it hasn't been changed ad hayom hazeh. The Palestinian covenant remains exactly what it was. The first commitment that was made. How is it possible to deal with these people? How is it possible to enter into negotiations or deal with these people? First commitment that was, by the way, not a matter that the first commitment wasn't kept. None were kept. And our people kept turning a blind eye, moving headlong on. Can't do that. We were living then with the feeling that, oh, any day now it's all going to fall apart. It's all going to unravel. Everybody's going to wake up and they're going to realize that this was a terrible mistake. Never happened. It never happened. Kept going. Just kept going. I remember the story of the Johannesburg tape. You remember the Johannesburg mosque tape? Arafat spoke in a mosque in Johannesburg a few months after Oslo was signed. And of all things, some fellow in the Jewish community, from the Mizrahi community, by the way, got a hold of a tape of the speech, handed it to a friend who was on his way to Eretz Yisrael. We had it in Eretz Yisrael. A day or two later, it was given over to a number of Middle East experts who listened to the tape, and it became them black before the eyes. Schwarz geworden vor die Augen. Man was saying very clearly that this is only a temporary arrangement until we are strong enough to be able to take all of Palestine. We brought this to the press. We thought that this is it. The man has said that he's simply not going to keep his agreement. We thought this would signal the end of it all. Nothing happened. He called for jihad. And I remember Peres getting up and saying, oh, what are you talking about, jihad? He means peaceful jihad. That a whole country didn't start laughing, I don't understand. He tried to convince everybody that there was a peace, such a thing as a peaceful jihad. There is no such thing. We turned a blind eye. People didn't want to face the truth. People in power could not get themselves and cannot get themselves ad hayom hazeh to say we made a terrible mistake. Individuals have had the courage, have had the guts to say it was a terrible mistake. By the way, I don't think we're without the Rebbeinu Shem, and this is not Frumkeit. I'm not passing off Frumkeit on you anymore. There's no way we're ever going to get ourselves out of this without God's help. Not a chance in the world. There's not a thing we can do. So there was the Joburg Moscow tape. Speaking about Mizrahi, they tell me once that when Yosef Berg, all of Ashalom, came to visit Johannesburg, so he said, you should know, Joburg has come to Joburg.
Where's Joseph?
Everything was beginning to unravel, it was clear. But despite that, the Oslo Express kept chugging along. And the casualties grew. I remember then visiting the United States on a mission to do something about it, and I was talking with Gary Rosenblatt, the editor of the Jewish Week. And one of us in conversation said to him something about the Korbanot HaShalom. Jews who were being killed were called by the government the sacrifices of peace. Somebody said it. Somebody in the room. Gary Rosenblatt said, What did you just say? Can you say that again? What had sort of become the in thing to say in the country he was shaken to the very core. Peace is not supposed to have sacrifices. Peace is not supposed to have 1,000 or 2,000 dead Jews and tens of thousands wounded. It's supposed to be different. And nothing changed. It was maddening. It was an extremely maddening period of time. At so many points, we thought that, well, this is it, it's over, but they didn't get it. They simply didn't get it. There was something obsessive about the headlong rush ahead toward further disaster. There are times you have to get it. There's a Gemara in Chulin that says, during the course of that nocturnal struggle between Yaakov and the angel, we assumed that Yaakov had gone back to the other side of the river because he left some jars there. And then, while he's there trying to get the jars, this figure, this man, accosts him, and a struggle begins. And the struggle goes on for hours. Sometime in the middle of the night, or as it comes close to morning, the Gemara says that Yaakov Avinu turned to the man and he said, "V'chiganevata o kuvyustusata? Are you a thief or are you a murderer?" Forgive the pun. It finally dawned on Yaakov Avinu. He wasn't struggling with somebody who wanted to steal his jars. He was struggling with somebody who wanted to destroy him. Wanted him destroyed. Because he couldn't understand. If the man is struggling for hours and he's incapable of getting the jugs, go steal jugs someplace else. But he continues. Because it's not the jugs he wants. He wants Yaakov. One of the great slogans that is an absolute lie, and by now we should know it. All of this, everything that's happened has been based on the idea of shtachim tmurat shalom. Land for peace. Land for peace. It's absolutely false. There isn't enough land for us to give them unless we give it all. Because it's not the land that they want. It's not a struggle over land. It's a clash of cultures. There is nothing we can give them that will ever satisfy them. And the mistake that's been made for the last 11 years is we think it's a struggle over territory. I'll give you a shtickle here, you'll give me a shtickle there. We'll make a little compromise. That's not the issue at all. You know what we should have done during the course of the last 11 years? During the course of the last 11 years, we should have made a basic and fundamental study of Islam. And if we would have done that, we would have learned a great deal. Our leadership would have learned a great deal. There is absolutely no place for compromise. There is no place for compromise. According to Islam, any land that was ever theirs remains theirs forever. And they'll wait 1,000 years until they will get it. To use a Talmudic term, they believe that land that kidsho l'shata, if it was sanctified by them for a particular moment in time, kinshallah titlavo, it's theirs forever. They will never give up on a piece of land that they believe belongs to them. There's not a thing that we can give them that's going to satisfy them, because this is not a struggle over land. This is a struggle, a clash of religions. And Islam is one of the civilizations that is now growing in might and power throughout the world. They're beginning to feel a resurgence of what Islam once was. It's a nest that we exist. It's a miracle that we exist. But the moment that one realizes what Yaakov Avinu realized then, v'chiganev ata kuvyustasar ata, are you a thief or are you a murderer? And Yaakov realizes that he's dealing with a murderer, not with a thief. It's not somebody who wants his little jars. It's somebody who wants him, who wants him. And I'm always struck by the beauty of a pasuk that we read. We read the pasuk, and Sally read it 1,000 times. Toward the end, as the struggle ends, and dawn has already risen, so the Malach Sorrow Shalesov turns to Yaakov and he says, Shalcheini, send me away, ki Olo Hashacha, because dawn has arrived. Wait a minute. You hear that passage? Yaakov must have looked at me and said, you're mad. What do you mean, Shalcheini? I'm holding on to you? I brought you here? I attacked you? You came after me. What do you mean, Shalcheini, send me away? You know what the Malach is doing? The Malach is brilliant. He's turning the victim into aggressor. He's turning Yaakov into the aggressor. Yaakov, leave me be. What do you mean, leave me be? Yaakov doesn't know what hits him. He doesn't understand what's happening to him. Shalcheini, send me away, ki Olo Hashacha. We have been turned into the aggressors. And many of those who accuse us of being the aggressors are our own people. For how many years do we have our left that has been saying the conquest, the occupation? Conquest, occupation didn't belong to anybody. It's our land. We're turned into the aggressors. All the Powells and the others of this world, the moral equivalency. We have to stop the cycle of violence. You understand? There's a cycle of violence in the Middle East. You're violent, and you're violent. You're both violent. You know, our rabbis, they were brilliant. Meshe Chokhmah in Parshat B'Shalach brings a medrash. It appears in different forms, but the one that it appears in there is that here it is, the Yam Suf, the Red Sea, Jews are being pursued. You can hear the hoofbeats, the chariots of Paro. There's the dark, deep sea lying before them. Klal Yisrael caught in the middle. It's Dunkirk all over again, for the first time. There it is, it's Dunkirk. Klal Yisrael is going to be defeated. It's all going to be destroyed. So the Malachim. Now, a number of Medoshim, it says Samuel. Samuel sounds a little bit like small. Left. Samuel. Samuel says, can you hear what the Malach says? Madua halolu nitzolim v'halolu nitboim. Why are these being saved and those are being drowned? Halolu ovdei avodah zarah. These are idolaters, and these are idolaters. Understand? Moral equivalence or immoral equivalence. And the Rebbeinu, he knows how to respond. Shaitim Sheba'olam, he says, you fools! You don't see the difference between the aggressor and the victim? You don't see a difference between the one who enslaves and the one who's enslaved. Shaitim Sheba'olam. And we permit ourselves, and we even permit our own people, to accuse us of being the ones who are the obstacles to peace. Yes, 8,000 men, women, and children who've built their homes in Gush Katif, in Gaza, beautiful homes. They're the aggressors. They're the ones that have to be removed. Somebody said recently, you know, we get shook up, you can read it in the paper every day, about graffiti on gravestones in France. or swastikas on synagogue someplace else in the world, and we get all shook up. We get all shook up about anti-Semitism in the world, very anti-Semitism. Tragically, and I say this with great pain, there's one country in the world in which Jews are going to be forcibly removed from their own home. Only one country in the world. And we get all shook up about graffiti and swastikas. So there's the form of blindness called turning a blind eye. There's another form of blindness. One of my favorite Werther of Marshall McLuhan. Marshall McLuhan once said, and I have to listen very carefully. Marshall McLuhan once said, "I wouldn't have seen it if I hadn't believed it." Now you have to let that sink into the kishgut, you understand? I wouldn't have seen it if I hadn't believed it. We've been taught since childhood seeing is believing. So along comes Marshall McLuhan and he tells us, no, punkt verkehrt, the opposite. The real truth is that believing is seeing. And the truth is that he's absolutely right. I remember I was very upset when I saw that. It was an early morning. I was very upset. I was gewaltig gewort by this guy, Marshall McLuhan. What's going on over here? I was terribly, terribly disturbed. So, and a whole davening, I go to shul, a whole davening. The end of davening. It was the second day of Rosh Chodesh Elul, and we said L'David. At the end of L'David, Lulei he'emanti lid'ot b'tov Hashem v'eretz chayim. If I wouldn't have believed, I wouldn't have seen the goodness of God. And then all of a sudden, I began to see Marshall McLuhan's work all over Torah. I took a look up. The parochas in my shul in Har Nof has emblazoned on the pasuk Zekeli van Veu Elokei Ovi Varom Emenu. This is my God, and I will exalt him, the God of my father, and I will raise and uplift him. One of my favorite Rashi's, one of the great Rashi's. Rashi says, Jews at the Red Sea, why did they have to say Elokei Ovi, the God of my father? They said Zekeli. They saw God, a maidservant. Saw more than the prophets had seen. So why did they have to say, Elokei Avi, the God of my father? So Rashi says, Lo ani tchilat hakedusha, I'm not the beginning of all of this sanctity. Ele murzeket omedet likedusha tov, ele puto alai miyimei avotai. God's sanctity and his divinity is with me from the days of my fathers. You know what Rashi is saying? Rashi is saying, Marshall McLuhan, I wouldn't have seen him at the Yam Suf if I didn't believe in him because of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. When you believe, you have a different perspective on life. I want to do a little takeoff on Marshall McLuhan. I want to say, if you don't believe, you don't see. Now you'll understand in a moment what I have in mind. If you don't believe, you just can't see. One of the mistakes of our leadership, and again, this is with great pain, I have to say it, they're not religious Jews. They're not believing Jews. They're secular. Not only are they secular, there are those who have an absolute contempt for Yahdut. Sometimes, by the way, this can work out very well for us. The Sharon government is on the brink of falling because of somebody who hates religious Jews. So this is in our favor right now. Thank God Tommy Lapid hates Chum Eden and Torah that much that he's ready to bolt the government rather than $64 million being given to religious schools, I understand. It's terrific. I'm so thrilled with what he did. It's great. We need, you know, a chiloni at the right place at the right time to be just what you need to bring a government down. You know, Tommy Lapid could do what our Maftal couldn't do. Maftal's been telling us for months that they're going to bring down the government. Anyway. Hey, please don't tell them this in Eretz Yisrael. You know, I'm supposed to be a member in good standing of the Central Committee of Maftal. That's the most that I do in politics in the country. If you don't believe, you don't see. Do you know what our secular leadership could not see? They could not see that the people who they were negotiating with are Muslims. And that they have standards and they have beliefs. And they're not going to compromise on any of their beliefs. The person who's been able to compromise away or do away with all of Yavus, with Shabbos, with Kashrus, simply has no respect for religion. And if you don't have respect for religion, you can't appreciate it or understand it in somebody else. You think that with gives with anything, you know, a little compromise here, a little compromise there. Yeah, don't have to be so from. They don't understand. Perez and Balin, Sarid, they didn't understand that they're dealing with Muslims. And Muslims take their religion very seriously. If they would have had belief, they would have been able to see the situation far more clearly. But because they don't believe, and they think that they're citizens of the world, and see the world in its greater and broader context, they couldn't see what was taking place before their very eyes. They will never give up what they consider to be their rights to Har HaBayit. Barak was ready to give up on Har HaBayit until 400,000 Jews led by Sharansky surrounded the walls of Yerushalayim. Klal Yisrael is not ready to give up on Har HaBayit yet. He was ready to make this insane deal, you understand, that the top layer of earth on Har HaBayit will be to the Muslims. The lower layer is going to be... Does it sound crazy? Why aren't you all laughing? It's so mad. Yeah. The lower layer, you understand, the layer that they dug out already and threw out, that's going to be ours. Korban Bayit Sheni, by the way, the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash has not ended. It's going on under our very eyes right now. If you don't believe, there's so much that is closed from before your very eyes. You just can't see. You can't see it. The conflict is a religious conflict. It's not a conflict over land. That's not what it is at all. We started talking about Islam. Islam divides the world into two places. There's Dar el-Islam, lands that are held by Islam, and Dar el-Harb, and those lands that have to be taken by the sword. There's no other possibility. There's no other possibility. Those are the only two fundamental part of the creed of Islam. If they would know that, if they would appreciate it, if they would understand the depth of religious commitment. Jihad is also a basic and fundamental part of Islam. Christianity believes in proselytizing. Jews mind their own business. Muslims have a mitzvah to make everybody in the world a Muslim. The Rambam had to flee time and time again from before the Muslims. Jews at the time of the Rambam were given the choice of accepting Islam or dying by the sword. That's what they want to do. And with their resurgence now, it's going to be a problem that is going to grow from country to country. We've only seen the beginning. You know, the world doesn't understand. I think it was Eric Hoffer who wrote in 1967, as it goes with the Jews, so it will go with the rest of the world. When terrorism began and it only affected us, the world didn't care. What they didn't realize is they too were going to become the victims of terror. We are the victims of a resurgent Islam. The tragedy is we made ourselves the victims. We invited them in. Because our leadership didn't appreciate, didn't understand, didn't know what Islam is all about. So many of those who were involved feel nothing but contempt for religion in general and Judaism in particular. They can't appreciate, they can't comprehend the mind of a believer. They didn't see because they didn't believe. Their own rejection of religion is a serious block to their ability to see. Religious people don't compromise their religion. Just last week in Yerushalayim, we had the biennial convention of the OU. 1,000 people. They were afraid to have it in Yerushalayim because who's going to come to Yerushalayim for a convention? Turned out to be the largest convention in the history of the OU. 1,000 people. It was in the Renaissance Hotel. The boss of the Renaissance Hotel is a member of my shul in Harnof. They had a room set up for davening, 1,000 chairs. He says there hasn't been a hotel in all of Eretz Yisrael since the time of Avraham Avinu that had a shul for 1,000 people to daven there. So I met a fellow, a judge, Jewish fellow from Far Rockaway or Lawrence. He's a judge. So he, after listening to a tirade of mine, so he comes over and he tells me, I have something to say to you. After he was appointed a judge, he was required to attend a seminar, a few days seminar, learning about the art of negotiation, mediation, compromise. They had to go to the West Coast, and judges from all over the United States who had been recently appointed had to be present at this gathering. So he says there was an elderly judge who was brilliant. He taught them all sorts of means of negotiation, mediation, compromise, the way to be able to resolve disputes without the necessity for law. At the end of the seminar, he said the following: every conflict in the world today can be resolved by negotiation, except one, the Arab-Israeli conflict. How he was so brilliant, I don't know. He says it's impossible. It won't work. There's a fifth, and this is the final form of blindness. This is another form of blindness that the Mesilat Yesharim could never, ever have imagined. And it's difficult to imagine it now, but I have to say it exists. It exists. It's the most pitiful and most pathetic. There are people who don't see because they don't look. There are people, fellow Jews, who are simply indifferent to what's happening in Eretz Yisrael. Lo ma'anyen otam. They're not interested. It's not the world in which they live. They just don't look. You can only see if you turn to look. But if you don't turn to look, you don't see. I remember it was in a luncheonette. I think it was in June. In a community in Brooklyn. I had gone to the United States to speak about Aliyah. In Flatbush, I spoke. By the way, a lot of people came. And they say that the figures for Aliyah from Flatbush are rising rapidly. You could have laughed a little bit. That's all right. No, no. People were interested. People came. I spoke in Teaneck. 1,000 people I spoke to in Teaneck. Teaneck, in fact, does have people coming on Aliyah. It was the morning after Tali Hatuel and her children were executed. Sitting there with the newspaper and the luncheonette and crying. Bashit, tears are coming down. I'm crying. Uncontrollable. Uncontrollable. I look next to me on one side. Fellas reading the sports section. He didn't start the front side of the newspaper. He started the back side. There's a fellow on the other side who's reading the financial section of the paper. And I think to myself, God Almighty, what kind of a world am I living in? I would have thought that anybody with a Yiddish heart would open up the paper and see the picture of a mother and four daughters. No, there are Jews who are indifferent. They don't look. They don't look. They don't see. So you can just go about your business and go about your business. And sometimes I speak to these people, and they have it all figured out. They know exactly what has to be done, and they give you all sorts of advice, and they tell you don't bang your head against the wall, don't demonstrate, it's nothing, it's a Buddhist health, and the Rebbeinu wants it. It's unbelievable. It's a form of blindness. The most serious form of blindness of them all. Different. I'll tell you a painful statement that was written by Rav Kook in 1907. Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook Zeh Tzadik Kikadosh Livracha. 1907 he wrote, you know, he's been accused throughout all of the years that he couldn't see. He was so overcome with Ahavat Yisrael that he couldn't see what secular Judaism was going to become. The Zionists. He wrote in 1907, it's in his letters, first volume, page Kuf Peichet. So as you take a look at them, they're Jews on the outside. A little bit of Hebrew, a little bit of Ahavat Eretz Yisrael, but inside they're all Goyim. And there will come a day in the future when it's going to turn into Sinat Yisrael and Sinat Eretz Yisrael. We're at that day. There are those who cannot wait until Jews will be dragged forcibly from their homes in Eretz Yisrael. And not only in Gush Katif, all of you who daven Shomron. A secularism that has bred Sinat Yisrael, Sinat Torah Yisrael, and Sinat Eretz Yisrael, and Rav Kook saw it more clearly than anybody else. I would suggest you have a chance, you have to read Bernard Lewis's books on Islam. He's the Gobel in the world on Islam. You have to read Samuel Huntington, Clashes of Civilization. A whole world will open up before you. Your eyes will open up to see things more clearly. About disengagement. Just a few words about disengagement and what's happening in Eretz Yisrael today. Number one, there was an article in Haaretz a few weeks ago written by Yaakov Amidror. General Yaakov Amidror is the highest ranking dati in the Israeli army. Yaakov Amidror was in charge of intelligence. He wrote an article in Haaretz, and I'm only going to tell you one paragraph. The one paragraph says the following. And I'm saying this for the sake of those, because I know there's somebody who's going to tell me, our policy is that we stand behind whatever the government, the duly democratically elected government of the State of Israel decides, we stand behind them. You know, this sounds like a very noble position to take. It's a gross cop-out. If I got a few people upset now, that's good. Then we're in for a good discussion. Yaakov Amidror writes the following. The meeting at which Sharon decided on this engagement, the following people were present. Sharon, members of his family, his image builders, and his personal lawyer. Not a single member of the military establishment was there. Not a single member of the military establishment was asked. He ends by saying the entire military establishment is opposed to it because it poses a real threat to the security of the state of Israel. And then, most probably the most painful thing of all, the kulam shotkim, and all of them remain silent. Nobody has the courage to say, you're doing something terrible. So therefore, anybody who's going to come and tell me, you know, Rabbi, what do you know about politics? What do you know about international relations? The generals are the ones we have to ask. By the way, for weeks after that, till I came, I kept watching the Haaretz every day to see, is somebody going to challenge Yaakov Amidror? Nobody has challenged him. He has accused the entire military establishment of being cowards. Nobody has challenged him. I want you to know that the only thing I have to do tshuva for in Yom Kippur is reading the Haaretz every day. And then I really wonder whether I have to do tshuva, because the very reading of the Haaretz every day is already an einish in and of itself. But I've told the fellas in my shul, there's a story about a Roshiva. The students have been told about the Roshiva that he's completely in the world of the spirit. He doesn't read newspapers. They caught him. Bershit, somebody caught him one day reading a newspaper, and it sent shockwaves through the yeshiva. The yeshiva is reading a newspaper. So they came to him. You know, Talmidim sometimes have the right. Davo Seinu, did you read Krishna yet? You understand? He gives my Pierce Rosh's artist. They come to the yeshiva and they said, you were caught reading the newspaper. And you were caught reading the newspaper in the morning before you went to shul. So he says, sure, I read the newspaper. You know why I read the newspaper? Because then I know exactly what to daven for. I read the Haaretz every morning before I go to davening, and I know exactly what to pray for. That's number one. Number two. The fact is that democracy is being trampled upon in Eretz Yisrael today. Democracy is being trampled upon. It's in grave danger. We're talking about the one democracy in the Middle East. What's going on is not democratic. And you know enough. You read the papers and you know exactly what's going on. Then there was another article by one of the great leftists in the Haaretz, and he said, and that soldier is going to stand before that settler and tell him, get out of your house or I'm taking you out, that day should never come. That soldier had better know that he has the full authority of Klal Yisrael, that an overwhelming majority of the Jewish people have sent him. Otherwise, that settler has the right to tell him, get off my land or else. We've sort of gotten used to the idea that Jews can be uprooted from their homes. I would have thought that an Israeli government would make it clear to a whole world, it's non-negotiable. It's non-negotiable. You've waged war with us for 56 years. And I don't hear it. I don't hear it. Because there's a lack of clarity of vision. What's necessary is not only clarity of vision. I've got to end on a good note. This has been bad, you understand? But even the bad, it's important. We have to be able to see. We have to be able to perceive. We have to be able to understand. We can't be blinded. We can't be indifferent. We have to be able to have the courage to say what has to be said. There was a story 2 years ago. What a beautiful story. I get choked up. Chomat Magen, when finally the government went out to destroy terrorism. So that they had said that Tzal, there's no morale in Tzal. It was right around Pesach time 2 years ago. The reserves that were called up, 120% of soldiers came to their units. Those who didn't have to come came to their units. I remember it was in Hanof, in Ranan, and other places, women were baking and cooking and sending stuff out to the soldiers in Jenin, in Nablus, all sorts of places, till the army had to tell them, Mamaluk, Yiddish Mamaluk, the Kinder haben was zu essen, we're going to take care of them. There was a fellow by the name of Avram Gutman, who was 51 years old, but he went to Jenin and he joined his group. And he didn't have to, but no, he's going to be there. On the first or second day of the fighting, his cell phone rings, and he doesn't want it in the middle of a battle, either. No, somebody comes and says, this is an important phone call. His mother calls. She's 92 years old. And she tells him, Avremela, I want you to know two things. Number one, you take good care of your soldiers and you make sure that they all come home. And second, you know that I was in Auschwitz. I want you to take my nekuma from all those sending Yisrael. She hung up the phone. A few hours later, the phone rings and he's notified that his mother had died. He went home for the Levaya, and by the on the Beis Shalom, he said, don't anybody come to be Menachem Avil. I'm going back to my unit in Jenin because I consider that to be my mother's savor to me. He goes back to his unit. The following day, the commander-in-chief happens to be checking in the area, and he meets Commander Avram Gutman, and he sees a soldier with his jacket torn. Yes, that's right. My mother died. Why aren't you home sitting shiver? He tells him about the last phone call that he had from his mother. And he said, I'm sorry. This was her tzavah. I have to take her in the tummer, and I have to take care of my soldiers. So the commander, she said, I order you to go home and sit shiver. So he says, I disobey your orders. The commander-in-chief told the people around him, write down every word. I want everybody to know this conversation. There are times when you don't obey your orders. A pasuk in Yeshayahu, Ha'om ha'olchim b'choshech, a people that's going in the dark, Ro or Godol, they saw great light. Yoshvei be'edetz talmaves, those who live in the shadow of death, or noga aleihem, light began to shine upon them. I think that passage in Yeshayahu takes us back to our Mesilat Yesharim. There are those who can't see because of the darkness. Ha'om ha'olchim b'choshech, you know what they need? Or Godol, a great burst of light. And they can see the obstacles in their path. They can go with assuredness. But then there are the so-called intellectuals who believe they know better than everybody else. Those who have this skewed view of life. The second the second blind ones of the Mesilat Yesharim. The ones who see good as evil and evil as good, theirs going to be more difficult. Yoshi, because they're settled into the edits of others, or Noga'aleim, little by little, the light is going to shine upon them. I have a feeling that may very well be the machloket of Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. Beit Shammai say, on the first night of Hanukkah, you light 8 candles, and then 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Beit Hillel say, and that's what we do, you start the first night with 1, and you work your way up to 8. Beit Shammai is talking about ha'om ha'holchim b'choshech, people who are walking in the darkness. You know what they need? Or gadol, one big burst of light, and they can see what's ahead, and then it begins. You can let the light diminish. Beit Hillel is talking about the intellectuals who think that they know better than anybody else. Or with them, you're going to have to start off with a little light the first night. And then you're going to give them another little light because they can't take it. By the third night already, they're going to have their sunglasses because they're not used to all of this light. But little by little, little by little, or no Galilean, it will ultimately be able to see the truth. One pasuk, and with this I close. It's just that it's a pasuk that it's become part of my neshama. It's a prayer. The end of chapter 65 in Yeshayahu, he says, "V'sasti b'Yerushalayim, I will be full of joy in Yerushalayim, v'galti v'ami, and I will be happy with my people, v'lo yishama od, and never again will be heard in Yerushalayim, kol b'chi, the sound of weeping, the kol z'aka, and the sound of sighing." Do you know what we've learned to live with for 11 years? Thank God the last few months it has diminished. For years now we've been living in Yerushalayim. You hear an ambulance going through the street. You take note. A second ambulance, and you turn on the radio and you know that there's been an attack. That's what we've been living, that's what we've been trained. We know it already. Thank God we haven't had one now for months. And unfortunately, all the Kabbalists were great people. That last bus in Yerushalayim was Chezi Goldberg. Shem Yinkam Dama of Toronto was killed. Tremendous. Tremendous person. So the tefillah is, Lo Yishona Ba'od, shouldn't hear an Eretz Yisrael call the theme, the sound of crying, the kol zaka, but rather we should see Or Naga Aleim, the light, that we should begin to see the truth, and we should know exactly what we are facing and be able to face it with confidence, with strength, with a sense of real betachon and emunah in the Rebbeinu Shlom. Hanukkah Sameach.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have been challenged this evening, and perhaps you have the opportunity now to challenge Rabbi Gold. He has graciously agreed to accept a few questions, and what we'll do is we'll take the few questions together, and then Rabbi Gold will respond to them all at once. Anyone, please? I would ask only that you pose a question rather than making a long speech. Anyone? Please.
What can I do here, now?
Question was, what can I do here, now? Someone over there had a question? Please.
The conservative reform rabbi sent a letter to Bush recently urging him to force Israel to use a compromise or whatever the word is. Where are the Orthodox rabbis?
Yes.
Other than individual education, how are we going to make all those blind leaders see?
Anybody else? Yes, please.
What can we do to have this beautiful rabbi as the light that everybody needs?
I like that question.
You want to repeat the question?
No, no, no.
What can we do to have Rav Gold as
become Prime Minister?
It's the, just the question he wanted to hear. Please.
If somebody doesn't
understand what's happening in Israel, even though they're following it, if that's still considered blindness.
Why don't they understand?
Because they may not understand the concept of what's happening. Going
on. Maybe one more. Yes, please.
How long do you think Canadians have before Muslims start up here?
Okay, we may have maybe one more at the back, please.
Can you come a little closer? Come a little closer. All of the questions were good. Certainly the question that has to be addressed more, I mean, the last question. Question that was asked really is if, I think she got the idea that I'm in favor of soldiers disobeying orders, not to follow orders to remove fellow Jews from their homes, which of course raises the problem. It can undermine the entire discipline of an army. It can throw an army into a terrible, terrible state, because then you're going to have the left who will say that they're not going to follow orders under other circumstances. This is most probably really the most serious problem, most serious immediate problem with regard to the disengagement. Who's going to do it? And what happens if a soldier is asked to do it? Should he refuse or shouldn't he refuse? I've gone on record, together with many others, as saying, yes, they have to disobey orders. The reason why I personally feel this way, and I wrote it in the Jerusalem Post a few weeks ago, to me it's unthinkable that 60 years after the Holocaust, an Israeli soldier must follow orders that he finds to be personally immoral. Follow orders? There's one person who was executed in all of the 56 years of the State of Israel, and that was Eichmann. For one reason, because he followed orders. You're going to tell me the Israeli soldier has to follow orders? I also wrote in that item, a few years ago there was an interview with a soldier who had been on the beach when the Al-Talena, in 1948, the Al-Talena came in, and Rabin gave orders to shoot at the Al-Talena and sink it. The first person he gave the orders to said he refuses to follow orders. He was court-martialed immediately and thrown into jail. His friends are the ones who shot the cannon that sunk the Al-Talena and killed 14 Jews. He was interviewed, he's now in his 80s. He said, the happiest and greatest decision he ever made in his life was to disobey orders. He's been a fortunate human being, and he knows that his friends who did fire the shots were unhappy and depressed their whole lives. they never forgave themselves for doing it. I also wonder at times, you know, 40 years, 50 years down the line, an Einikel is going to ask, Saba, what did you do by the disengagement? What did you do? Do you think Saba's going to say, Einikel, Tayyar Amayna, boy, did I schlep those Jews out of their homes? He will want to cover himself in shame for the rest of his life. Technically, I was also part of the first Psak Halacha, together with Rav Avraham Shapira, Rav Nachum Rabinowitz. You know, Toronto grows them a little extreme. Yeah. That Psak Halacha was a Psak Halacha that was addressed to Rabin, and it called upon the Prime Minister not to put soldiers in a position where they will have to refuse orders. Don't put them in a position where they are going to be faced with that dilemma. And the army can do that now too. But the only time they will consider doing that is if they know that soldiers will indeed refuse orders. Then they'll make sure that the soldier who is likely to refuse orders is not going to be asked to do it. Does it create a problem? Sure, it creates a problem. We have a lot of problems. But then we have to be able to weigh, where does morality stand? To say that an Israeli soldier must follow orders? So the Eibush the Rapid. What can we do here and now?
Not tomorrow. Tomorrow's too late.
Well, I'm sorry, I had a rough day. I don't know what to do here and now. Well, the only thing I can tell you to do here and now, stay up all night and say Tillim. I don't know. I remind myself now, the last time I spoke here in B'nai Torah in the shul, it was on Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av 94 or 95. 95, there was a demonstration, the first time there was a demonstration in front of the Israeli consulate on Avenue Road, and from there we came here to Shul, and I spoke here, and I know that the leadership of Toronto, you know, the politically correct people, were appalled at the idea that Jews were demonstrating in Heiliger Avenue Road against the Israeli consulate. It was anathema. Thank God we did it. At least somebody had the courage to get up there in the street and shri Chai V'Kayam. The first thing is to say to them. The next is that you have to be able to attempt to see as clearly as you can. Number three, I hold that so many people that I meet here are already doing a great thing. Every person or every second person I meet has children living in Eretz Yisrael. It's unbelievable. Here and in the Bayit, you're half Israeli. Half. Just remember, only half. You have children in Eretz Yisrael, you're already doing something. Einikloch in Eretz Yisrael. So you're already doing a great deal. Somebody asked about the Reform and conservative and Reform rabbis. I ask you, in our community, there are those who say, and the OU, don't let it get back to the OU. The OU has come out that, you know, they stand behind the decision made by the Israeli government. Conservative and Reform rabbis are not afraid to go ahead and ask Bush to pressure Israel. Do you understand? This is betrayal of the Jewish people. It's unbelievable. Betrayal of the Jewish people. I don't understand how our members of their congregations don't get up and say, get off them already. Our whole world is down on Israel. We need you also to be down on them. Don't we have a friend in the world? We don't have one conservative and one Reform rabbi who is a friend who will at least understand that we're under enough pressure. These people should be condemned. And if you have guys like that here in Toronto, go. You have a job to do. Write a letter to the Canadian Jewish News, to the Tribune, condemn anybody who dares do anything to the sword. What else? Okay. How will we make blind leaders see? Mashiach. I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to do it. It's been our problem for 11 years. 11 years. I don't know how to do it. I know I don't have the answers. I remember somebody then asked me, I spoke January 31st, 1994. I spoke in the Sisterhood Hall at the Bayit. First time. It was entitled After the Handshake. After the handshake on the White House lawn. And somebody asked me the great question. Question that has always been asked by Peres. It's only understood when you say it the way it's Uma alternativa? And what is your alternative? So of course the alternative to committing suicide is not to commit suicide, right? That's a pretty reasonable alternative that should be given some consideration. You understand? How we will get them to see, I don't know. I don't know. It's mamish. When I use the word painful, I don't use it the way Sharon means it, you know. I remember days that it was so beautiful living in Eretz Yisrael. It's beautiful there now too, but there's constant tension. We don't know what's going to come. How long do we have? If somebody asked me, how long do we have before the Muslims take over? Get a hold of Samuel P. Huntington's book, Clashes of Civilization. You'll see that the moment of crisis is coming very close. It can be in 10 years. Europe already is suffering from it. I mean, aren't they surrounding Neri Soil up north over there? Yeah, it's all over. It's good that I got out. There's one question here that I haven't dealt with. I don't remember what it was, but I'll tell you the following. There was something else I said then, and I alluded to it here. And I think it has to be reiterated again. Not every problem is open for solution. And when you attempt to impose a solution on that which really has no solution, you're asking for trouble. We're in for a long haul, and the best thing that Eretz Yisrael can do is be absolutely strong. I can't understand this, but $1 billion will be necessary in order to remove 8,000 Jews from their home, and 1.5 million Jews in Eretz Yisrael are below the poverty line. 500,000 children go to bed hungry. We have $1 billion to remove 8,000 Jews from their home? Do you know what we can do for social services in Eretz Yisrael? Do you know what we can do for the poor? There should be different priorities. Since we don't have a partner out there, we have no one to talk to. Then you know what we have to do? The covered wagons around Eretz Yisrael, and start building ourselves up from within. We've got to bring a message of Yiddishkeit, and there are a lot of great organizations working on that. Whatever you want, both the Haredi community and the Dati Leumi community, there are yeshivot and kollelim sprouting all over the country. The beauty of Eretz Yisrael is the growth of Yiddishkeit there. Where country, cities and villages that never had, you never heard the voice of Torah there, you hear it there now. And that's going to make a big difference. But Mizrahi has 250,000 children in all of their schools. That's why I campaign for them. When it comes to election time, then they call me, understand? They know my phone number when elections come. And I go out and I campaign. 250,000. The Haredi community most probably is getting close to that number as well. We're growing in strength, in the quality of education, in the quality of Jewish life. Come on, a Ramat Beit Shemesh, a Modiin, a Chashmonoyim, a Kiryat Sefer, a Beitar, all of the communities in Yesha. There's an awesome amount of Torah being studied in that country. There's so much going on. By the way, the greatest explosion of Torah learning in all of history has taken place in that secular state of Israel. I learned in yeshiva there in 1955 and 56. You could count the number of yeshivas on one hand. There was a Chevron, there was a Panevish, there was a Mir. What did you have? You had nothing. And then in a matter of 20, 30 years, hundreds of thousands are studying Torah in all segments of the community. Awesome growth. That's the bright side of Eretz Yisrael. That's a very bright side. And you know what it's part of? It's Beis Hillel. One candle, another candle, one community, one kollel, another yeshiva, another night kollel, another series of shiurim. It's growing and it's growing. And in Yitzhak Hashem, we're going to turn the tide. We're going to win.